session number 8984, rule number 4.
Commander Dreyer, reel 4.
I suppose this is now the middle of May, and we've spent the next month, 3 weeks anyway, getting our boats shaken down into the Mediterranean conditions, getting used to operating in the different light. They had to be repainted for the rather paler camouflage colours used in the Mediterranean compared to the UK conditions. And of course the other four boats arrived after us, and I had to go along to Bougie, where they unshipped, and then bring them back to Bone. And we collected the whole flotilla together at Bone. And finally, somewhere in the last weeks of June, we sailed from Bone to Malta. I suppose perhaps about the 20th of June. I remember then that Pantelleria had not yet been captured, and in the course of our trip from Bone to Malta, we very nearly did an unscheduled landing on Pantelleria by mistake, because we thought it was Malta, which shows you how poor our navigation was in those days, or mine anyway. But we duly arrived in Malta, and very soon after our arrival we were briefed for the coming operation of the capture of Sicily, Operation Husky. And our job in MTBs was to block the Straits of Messina, and every night throughout the operation there were three units of three boats, usually, sometimes four boats, stacked through the Straits of Messina, a unit of small boats at the top end between Messina itself and Reggio, opposite on the Calabrian coast, and then two further units of larger boats further south from that. And the whole aim was that if any attempt by the Italian Navy was made to come through and interfere with the landing forces lower down towards the southern part of Sicily, we were there to stop them getting through the straits. Throughout the operation, only one Italian cruiser did come through the straits, and it came through at 40 knots, turned sharp left when it got to the bottom, and went straight round to Taranto and never made any attempt to interfere. But what it did do was sink one of Denis Germain's 70-foot boats from the 10th flotilla on its way through, and the MTBs failed to stop it.
Did they score any hits on it?
No. They didn't. It was a very formidable opponent, that, with most powerful guns and going so frightfully fast that they only had a very short space in which to get in position to attack, they had very little warning of its coming, and it was through them and had sunk one boat before they knew it was there at all.
Did you not actually see it yourself?
No, I wasn't out that night. In the course of that operation, our major success was the sinking of a U-boat. And on one night, soon after the start of the operation, we were lying stopped quite close off Messina itself, where the narrows are only a mile and a bit across, and we heard the tumph 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 noise of a diesel engine coming down, and we started engines and were looking wild, and we suddenly saw a shape coming and a wash and a bow wave, and it was quite clear it was coming very, very close to us indeed. So we all went astern to get out of the way, and the U-boat passed about 50 yards across our bows, much too close to fire at, and we were just going to start and follow to attack it when we saw a second one coming behind the first, and so we continued to go astern and made enough space between us and him to clear the torpedo warhead safety mechanism, which actually in that particular type of elderly torpedo that we had at that time is only 100 yards. But I think we were probably about 200 yards away when we fired, and one could hardly miss, and the U-boat blew up, bits landing all over us, and that was a very satisfactory outcome. And we then chased off after the first one. The other two boats had already gone chasing him, and we fired, I think, one more, two more torpedoes at that one, which missed, because he was hurriedly submerging, and they fired across his bow, and we all dropped depth charges, and hoped we'd at least frightened him. And then we went back to look and see if there were any survivors off the first one, and we didn't find any. But while we were doing that, two E-boats came down, and stupidly we thought there were two more U-boats, and fired our remaining torpedo at them on the basis that they were doing about 18 knots, but in fact they were E-boats doing about 30 knots, and we missed very, very comfortably. So we followed them down, doing enemy reports as we went, to the next boats in line, and Tom Fuller, the celebrated Canadian, in a D-boat, who was next door to us in the next patrol, collected this party from us and sank both E-boats very comfortably. He sank one and drove the other ashore on fire. And then to end that dramatic night, it really was rather a dramatic night, as we were setting out for home early in the morning with no torpedoes left, and quite elated with our success, we met on the way back in 9 German E-boats coming up in line ahead, and we were obviously absolutely no match for them at all. So we eased gently away, and for some quite unknown reason they let us go, and we passed about 1,000 yards apart in broad daylight on opposite courses, and it wasn't until we were almost past them that they started firing. But of course, I mean, 1,000 yards is much too far in those little boats to be at all reasonably accurate. They did wound a couple of chaps, but nothing serious at all, and practically no damage done. So we escaped from that lot. And then we came back to Malta and got more torpedoes, and we went on patrolling. And for the whole of the Sicilian campaign, we... I don't know how long it lasted, but about 6 weeks, I suppose, we did patrols every other night up into the Straits of Messina. And after a bit, we didn't have to go the whole way back to Malta, because we got an advance base in Augusta in Sicily, and used to operate from there. So one did 10 days on in Augusta, going up and down every night, and then went back to Malta and had 3 or 4 days off. But they kept the patrols going all the way through the operation till it finished, and the Messina was captured. Well, at the end of that period, or somewhere in the later part of the Sicilian operation, I got sick again with this dreary undulant fever, and I was in hospital in Malta for a few weeks, and then was invalided home. And I arrived home, I suppose, somewhere about the middle of November of 1943. And I got some sick leave, and somewhere just about Christmas time, I was asked to go to the Admiralty and write the confidential book on the operation of Coastal Force craft. And I joined the operations division coastal, it was called, of the naval staff, in order to write this book. And I spent January and February preparing and writing the first draft in the Admiralty in London. And then at the end of February, I suddenly got told that I was to go to Portsmouth and join the new Captain Coastal Forces Channel as his staff officer. And we had had for some time, I suppose for 18 months now, a Captain Coastal Forces Nor, who looked after all the Coastal Force craft in the Nor command, that's off the East Coast, and now there was to be one set up in the Channel. Of course, I didn't know it at the time, but what this was for was the invasion, which was to happen in the summer of 1944. But roughly on the 1st of March 1944, I joined the staff of CNC Portsmouth at Fort Southwick on the Downs behind Portsmouth Harbour, and initially as the staff officer operations for the Captain Coastal Forces Channel. And our job, the Captain Coastal Forces' job, was firstly to operate all the Coastal Force craft in the Portsmouth command, and secondly to coordinate the operation of Coastal Force craft in the Dover and Plymouth commands as well, and thirdly to oversee the control from shore of all operations going on in the Channel. And this was perhaps the most important part of his whole operation, really, was this shore control. And by now, shore radar throughout the UK was a highly efficient operation, largely worked by the Air Force, but to some extent by the Navy and the Army as well, and all telling in to shore plots in the three major commands in the Channel, for example, that is the Dover Command, the Portsmouth Command, and the Plymouth Command, and the two sub-commands at New Haven and Portland. All of those had a plotting room with a huge table chart of the Channel area, and the radar stations told in by landline to the Wren or WAF or AT operators sitting on the table plot, who kept a complete control of the movement of every ship moving in the Channel. And this, rather like the operation of fighter command controls, was a complete system of naval operating, and something totally novel to any of us. And it took quite a lot of getting used to and quite a lot of coordinating to get the system right, of both from the telling in from the radar sets direct to the Wren operators on the plots, and the making use of this information as it came in, particularly when the information was of enemy plots, and getting that information out to the patrols in the Channel. Now, we had the job also, of course, as soon as the operation was announced, of making all the preparations for the use of coastal force craft throughout the invasion. And they had a major part to play. Most of it out of the Portsmouth Command. We had to get organized to operate something over 100 MTBs out of Portsmouth, and about another 100 from New Haven, Portland, Dover and Plymouth, and something like 200 MLs and harbour defence MLs throughout the whole area, and about another 50 US MTBs and 50 US Coast Guard cutters, which came in the last stages of the preparation of the operation. So we had to build up a fairly tremendous base organization for maintenance and repair and care of all these boats, and indeed quite a problem of berthing all these boats. And we also had to plan their operation and the control of their operations. We had, in fact, although we didn't know it then, 3 months in which to do this, March, April and May, and we also had to develop during that period a new concept of operating the boats with frigates with good radars controlling the boats on the far shore when they were outside the range of our own shore-based radars. Gradually, during the build-up period before the operation, before the landing, we acquired a staff of about 10 chaps, and I was able to get hold of Peter Scott, who was an old friend, to come and help me with the operating, and we got Freddie Dunlop, who was a great signalman, to come and look after the signal side of our staff, and we also got hold of a marvellous engineer called Bickerton, who had been on the staff of the Captain Coastal Forces Mediterranean, and he took care of all the logistic side of the maintenance and the maintenance arrangements through all the coastal force bases in the channel. It's easy now in retrospect to say just that the invasion operation was a tremendous success. Of course it was. What one failed to realise is often is quite what a monumental undertaking the whole thing was, and it was awe-inspiring to be involved as part of it throughout the 3 month planning stage and then the 3 months of the actual operation that we saw from June until the channel was cleared of the enemy by roughly the 1st of September. One of the things that was perfectly amazing in retrospect is the fact that, roughly speaking, everybody in the Fort Southwark, I don't know how many people it was, but a great many, in the vast tunnels underneath the fort where all the operational controls existed, there were hordes of Wrens, of naval officers, of Americans, some soldiers, some airmen as liaison officers, a great many communication people, largely Wrens. All this horde knew where the operation was going to take place, and most of them knew when. A little way inland from us was Southwark House, which was the navigation school in origin, but for the period of the operation became the headquarters of General Eisenhower, and there was a great horde of people there who also knew where the operation was going to happen and when, and how on earth this whole thing was kept secret with all these large numbers of people knowing, I have not the slightest idea to this day, but it remains that it did stay secret. Now, memories of that operation. For the first night, we had, roughly speaking, all our boats on patrol. I think I'm right in saying we had 96 boats out on patrol. And thereafter, we kept a large proportion of our boats in operation throughout the 3 months that the battle lasted. Our job for the MTBs was to protect the western side of the cross-channel convoy route from any attack by German surface ships coming up the channel or coming out of Cherbourg. The MTBs and destroyers attached to the actual task forces doing the landings were to take care of the E-boats and torpedo boats in Le Havre itself, and the Dover command took charge of the east side of the cross-channel convoy route to protect that from anything coming down the coast from Holland and Germany. There wasn't very much that could come other than E-boats from that direction, but on the west side, of course, there were Narvik-class destroyers and torpedo boats and, of course, U-boats in the ports on the west coast of France. And there were the 5th and 9th E-boat flotillas in Cherbourg, and I think I'm right in saying it was the 4th E-boat flotilla in Le Havre. As the operation progressed, the nothing happened with surface ships, roughly speaking, at all. There was one brief excursion from the west coast which was picked up and attacked by destroyers in the Channel Islands area, or west of the Channel Islands. The only German Navy operations that caused any trouble at all were the E-boats, and they operated a little bit out of Le Havre, out of Cherbourg, but were pretty well contained. They did operate a little bit out of Le Havre, and they did have one or two successes out of Le Havre. The Norwegian destroyer Svenna was sunk early on in the operation by an E-boat, and celebrated Gertz von Mirbach achieved torpedoing the Nelson on her way back from bombarding in the assault area. But the Nelson thought she'd hit a mine, but it wasn't. It was Gertz coming out of the mist. But generally speaking, our patrols managed to keep the E-boats under control and stopped them from doing practically any damage at all. Of course, we were greatly helped in the middle of the operation by a bombing raid on Le Havre, which sank certainly half a dozen E-boats in harbour there and reduced the opposition. Well, gradually Cherbourg fell, and then gradually the operation concentrated, from our point of view, in containing the portions of the German Navy left in Havre from coming out and doing any damage, and in the final stages stopping the, really blockading Le Havre and stopping any evacuation of ships from there, and obviously stopping any reinforcement coming into there, so that for the last fortnight, I suppose, of the operation, the last middle to late August, the concentration of the operation was off Cap d'Antife, which is the sort of knob above Le Havre, between Le Havre and St. Valery and Fécamp, to stop anything getting back into Le Havre to sustain the garrison there, and stopping anything evacuating Le Havre. And then, as I say, by the beginning of September, I think by the end of August, the channel was finally cleared and there was no enemy left in the channel. And then our job was virtually finished, and we had about another fortnight in the Portsmouth command writing our report of the whole operation and clearing things up, and all the boats were moved off up the east coast to go on with the battle on the East Coast till the end of the war. When we've finished our job, my wartime period in Coastal Forces ended then, and I was sent back to my school, HMS Vernon, and then reverted to general service.